The comments and opinions of the guests on Dishin' and Swishin' are not necessarily the views and opinions of the host of the show or the contributors and management of HoopFeed.com. The Dishin' and Swishin' podcast is meant for entertainment purposes only, and the inclusion on the podcast of any individual, entity, or institution is not to be considered an endorsement of any kind. You are listening to Dishin' and Swishin', the world of women's hoops, on HoopFeed.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's Dishin' and Swishin' podcast. It's one of my favorite ones to do, and one of the most popular ones that you all like to listen to. It is the NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament Preview Roundtable returns to talk about all things tournament, and we've got a great panel with you today. We're going to start out, we've got the AP's Doug Feinberg. We've got television and Pac-10 studio host Roz Gold on Wooday. We have LaChyna Robinson, who will also be covering games. She's all over the place usually, but she'll be with the ESPN family this weekend. And the guru, Mel Greenberg, is back with us to talk about all things that he'll be seeing and has seen from the Philadelphia area as well. Hi, everybody. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey.
All right, let's get started right away. And the first question that first thing that comes up is we've got the same number ones, and each of them have managed to beat another number one during the course of the time, be it Stanford over Baylor, Notre Dame over UConn, Baylor over Notre Dame, UConn over Stanford. Doug, is familiarity a good thing in the fact that we have the repeat teams? Does that help draw more people to watching this, or is it a problem that we're still getting the same teams?
Well, I don't know if it's a problem per se. I mean, there really wasn't much of a choice. Those four teams are so much better or distinguish themselves from the rest of the field over the course of the season, I mean, especially Baylor, Notre Dame, and UConn, who've only lost to each other for the most part. I mean, I guess the Stanford loss for Baylor, but it's just better. I mean, there's no doubt that those were the four best teams in the nation. And yes, it's familiar. Yes, you could say it's a repeat of last year, and there's a good chance you see all four of them in New Orleans. But you know what? They're the best teams. So it's always good to see really good teams get what they deserve, and that's the number one seed. So I'm all for familiarity. I don't like change.
Well, no wonder you like being on here, because we always seem to have the same people and do the same things, don't we? Especially if Baylor's always on top. So, looking at Baylor, LaChyna, Baylor went undefeated last year, brings everybody back this year. Is this a better team than last year's team?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, I think that the more experience this team has, the better they are. You know, I mean, you look at the core group with Jordan Madden and Brooklyn Pope and Destiny Williams, not even getting to Brittany and Odyssey. I mean, this is a team that's familiar with each other. They've been playing and improving their chemistry every year. And we've seen growth in them as individual players as well as a unit. So I don't think there's any way that they are not better than they were last year, considering the fact that they just had more time to gel and glue and, be even better than they were.
Yeah, David, Roz here, just to piggyback on that too. If you look at Brittany Griner's numbers from this season to last season, her numbers actually went down this year. It's not to say she's having a bad year. It's to say that her teammates are doing more. And I think one of the biggest growth pieces in that team is Brooklyn Pope. You know, her ability to come off the bench at times and score and rebound on top of the other starters, just being more reliable. And there are less moments where Baylor forgets to pass the ball into Brittany Griner, and I thought that was a weakness last season. And now they pass the ball into her, but it's not always for her to score. It's just to run the offense through her and get the right shot they want.
Roz, you bring up an excellent point, and that people sometimes don't pay enough attention to Brittany Griner, the passer, and the facilitator of the offense, and you're right. Brooklyn Pope has emerged this year. I thought Destiny Williams was going to step up and become an even stronger player this year. In fact, it's been Pope that stepped up that really has been a difference maker for that team. Now, you've been covering the working out there, and of course, I'm going to talk about your old alma mater there for a second. And Stanford is a situation there right now, you know, people always talk about Janae and how great a player she is, and that's rightly so. But, you know, I'm concerned if Toni Kokkinen can't play, people don't give her enough credit, and we're not hearing enough about she's ready and that she's going to play at 100%.
Yeah, Toni Kokkinen definitely deserves a lot of credit for the team in the sense that she's an excellent extra ball handling option. She has great speed. She helps break the press, which, you know, a lot come tournament time, a lot of teams like to increase the aggressiveness defensively against Stanford. She's also a year older than Amber Arron, so she brings some upperclassmen experience to help her out at the point guard spot. But likely, I don't see Toni Kokkinen playing in the tournament. But if she does, you know, keep in mind she's been out for weeks, more than a month with an injury. So, you know, that'll be tough for her. I don't think it matters as much right now just simply because Amber Arron has really grown into that point guard spot. And in the Pac-12 tournament, you saw the arrival of Amber Arron because Pac-12 coaches came out with great game plans. Colorado played them close. UCLA took them down to the very last basket in the Pac-12 championship. And Amber Arron had Shanae Agumake's back, who struggled, and she attacked the rim. She attacked the pressure. She got to the line. She finished at the rim, and she made great plays. And that's always been a question mark for Stanford, point guard play. And the sophomore, Ron, has answered it. She looks good. They have good momentum in that position going into the tournament.
Now, since we're talking about point guard play now, there probably has been no better floor leader, you know, this season in big games than Skylar Diggins at Notre Dame. But she's not all that there is. And it's good to see that Kayla McBride, who LaChina and I have been talking about for a couple of years now, is starting to get the publicity that she deserves. But Mel, this team really is stunning how much that Notre Dame has become a better team, in my opinion, than even last year's.
Yeah, and the amazing thing about it is going in, they had the audacity to be ranked like sixth or seventh, because I was just recapping our whole history for the season. And it seemed a long time ago that we thought, well, there'll be a high-quality rebuilding team as opposed to a rebuilt high-quality team, which is what they sort of became once they got things going early in the year.
Yeah, there's no question that, you know, Natalie Achunwa has taken that next step and become a quality post that can stay on the floor and make a difference. And they just, you know, that freshman, Jewel Lloyd, seems to have ice water in her veins too. And now, Doug, we've seen Notre Dame each of the time against Connecticut up here and out there, and we've seen what's happened. And it just seems that Connecticut has that mental block with Notre Dame that Notre Dame can handle them. But people are forgetting that Connecticut has only lost to the top two teams in the country.
Yeah, and by numbers-wise, it was lost by two, lost by one, and lost in triple overtime to Notre Dame. So we're talking maybe, what, two possessions, three possession difference between them being 3-0 against the Irish as opposed to 0-3. In the Baylor game, they were leading at the half. So it's strange to see a Connecticut team coached by Geno lose close games. It's not been something that's happened very often in his coaching career, but lately those two teams have had his number and had their number. I think you hit a little bit the point guard play. I mean, Skylar Diggins has run such a fantastic show for them, for Notre Dame, for the entire season, for her entire career. UConn just doesn't have that guard right now, except maybe Bria Hartley if she's in the game, to break somebody down defensively. I mean, they don't have the part, that person who can create shots for other people. I mean, Rod probably knows better than I do, like, how important it is to have a guard who can create and get shots for the teammates, because that makes life so much easier on offense. Instead of trying to run it through the high post to a Stephanie Dolson or run it through a Kelly Farris, you need to have that guard who can break people down and create for others, and that's what UConn seems to be missing right now. And the key to their run in the tournament probably is going to be Bria Hartley.
Yeah, no, Doug, you pointed out what I might have noticed from UConn as well, and I would agree with that. I definitely think guard play, in particular point guard play, is key. But when I look at UConn this year and I compare to old, you know, UConn teams of past, there was always an answer to, one, who is the go-to player? And there is no answer for that. There's a ton of amazingly talented players on this team. You can go to Dolphin. You can go to Stewart. KML is a great shooting option. Hartley can score. But who gets the ball in that clutch situation? It's not necessarily defined. And in the past, you know, it doesn't have to be just a point guard. Point guards get you into your offense. They help you get into the set you want to. But it could be a post player. You know, I remember in teams past, like, for example, when I was playing, you could run it through Jane Appel, and she would get your game winner. Or back in a couple of years ago, it would be Maya Moore for UConn. So I just think when it comes down to the clutch and closing out a game, they've looked a little lost. And especially in, like, you know, the last time they met up with Notre Dame in the Big East Championship, you know, it really is heartbreaking to think about how they lost that game. I mean, there's every, just from every breakdown that was possible, it happened in that last 20-something seconds. And, you know, should these two teams end up seeing each other, and that's if the seeds hold all the way down, it's going to be an amazing matchup, and it's really hard to beat a team, you know, what is it, three times, four times? What would it be for them, four?
Four.
Four, yep. Yeah. And, okay, I'll end here, and I'll say this. For Notre Dame, though, I came into this season, and I happened to talk to Sky, and she was like, people are really doubting on us, but we're not done yet. And I said, sure. And, no, she completely knew from the beginning that this wasn't going to be a top 10 team, you know, or a top 15. She knew she wanted to be top four. And I thought, I was saying, I think Coach Muffet McGraw could be Coach of the Year simply because of what how she's been able to carry a team that's lost so much. But I think now looking at it, I was wrong on that statement. I would say Muffet McGraw should be a candidate for Coach of the Year because of how she's developed young players. Like, forget the loss. I mean, you guys talked about McBride. She's a beast, you know. She is a serious number two scoring option, even number one. Sky runs the show. And then Lloyd bringing her confidence and understanding along. Like, there's a lot of development that happened over the course of the season for Notre Dame. They're much different now than they were at the beginning of the season.
Now, LaChyna, Raz brings up the topic of development over the course of a season. One of the teams that particularly is intriguing to me, because you look at the Duke Blue Devils, and here they started out strong with the weak schedule, then they lose Chelsea Gray, and they seem to be actually almost playing better with Alexis Jones at the point now, because they seem to have developed into their roles and really grown as they've gotten healthier, too.
Yeah, I mean, I've been impressed. I thought once Chelsea Gray went down, the Duke was really going to struggle. And, you know, the thing I think we forget about when it comes to Duke is that they have great players. I mean, you look at that junior class alone, and as a recruiting class was number one coming in, and, you know, they were a big class with Chelsea Gray, but you also have Liston and you have Peters, and Chloe Wells is a fantastic player. She was playing very well, you know, when she left last season because of academic issues or whatever. So they have depth. They have talented depth. And I think, you know, Joanne P. McCauley has done a great job of saying we're going to keep the ship moving and, you know, we have other players that can step up. And, you know, I think Wells isn't done. I think we will see them defer to her more during the NCAA tournament because of her experience and helping out Jones. But when you have a fearless freshman like Alexis Jones who really just plays unknowingly, you know, it's like she doesn't even know if she's playing AAU or that she's getting ready to play in the NCAA tournament. It's the same drive, the same desire night in and night out, and especially in big games. So, you know, I think Liston has done well. I like her off the ball. Don't like her as much at the point guard position. But then you have Elizabeth Williams who, you know, I think she's still only 75-80%. I personally, and watching her play and knowing her game from last year, but even at that percentage in terms of her health, she's still one of the best post players in the country.
I agree with you. I think that she is only 75 or 80% right now. She just doesn't seem to have that same ability to drive off the legs that she did last year that made her so unstoppable inside. But
She doesn't have that mobility. She doesn't have the mobility. I'm sorry, Dave. She doesn't have the mobility. And, you know, when I talked to her earlier this season, she said, you know, where I'm still trying to get things together is consistently posting up. You know, she's fatigued sometimes and getting down the floor and asking for the basketball. And then, I mean, if you remember last season, she was one of the best in the country in getting after offensive boards and even her own shot. You know, just how active she was. Doesn't have, you know, that much explosiveness yet. But like I said, even at 75-80%, she's still one of the best posts in the country.
And now, Mel, when you look at some of these, you know, you look at these other teams and the other seeds that are, you know, number twos and number threes, and you know, Kentucky got a number two seed, and they play a deep team. They're a deep team that plays a lot of bodies too. But the one I want to talk to you about is, you know, Penn State ended up with a three seed, you know, after doing so well this year, only dropping five games. The Big Ten was a tough conference. You know, they end up having to go to LSU and potentially play on their court. You know, Penn State, in my opinion, is a team that could go places, but they really got a raw deal.
Yeah, I was disappointed for them. And if you remember, they had to do the exact same thing last year. They had to win at LSU to advance
season,
which they did. But, I mean, goodness, I just thought that that was a tough draw. And I understand the G-curve and all that goes into it and the explanations about the predetermined sites, but I would have liked to see Coquise Washington's team, especially because they had been considered a two seed for much of the season, to at least get be in a better situation in the first and second round.
Mel,
that whole section is crazy, LaChina. Like, actually, last year in the tournament, I was calling the Baton Rouge region. So Penn State at LSU, in their home, it's just a rematch of that. And it's not that whole area, that whole region has teams playing on a lower seed's home court. You got Penn State in Baton Rouge, potentially could see LSU. You got Cal, the two seed, in Lubbock, you know, potentially could see Texas Tech. You got Stanford, again, eventually, if they continue to win out, you know, potentially could see Gonzaga in Spokane. And you know they draw in Spokane. They'll sell that whole place out.
Yeah, oh, gosh. So, it'll be magical.
Crazy. You know, this Gonzaga team is not Gonzaga teams of old. But, you know, you never know with them. They're always good for some kind of upset, you know, quality team by Coach Graves. But that's definitely a story in women's basketball, higher seeds playing on lower seeds courts. And Dave, you could take it back to me. I definitely think at some point here we got to talk about the potential of the Cal-Penn State matchup in the Sweet 16, because that's one of the most compelling Sweet 16 matchups out right now, potentially.
I agree, and thank you for letting me take it back, Roz. I do appreciate that. Okay, now I'm going to ask
on the line.
I'm going to ask the question to the guys now, okay? So let's let them have an answer, okay? All right.
We guess.
So, Penn State and Coquise Washington. Guard play is a key in these tournaments. Everybody knows that. But that's a team that if she can't get something out of Nikki Green, their front court is really something that could potentially hold them back. What do you think she needs to do to get that team to continue to play well?
Well, I mean, I guess you kind of said it, although many nights the, you know, that tandem of Maggie Lucas and, Alex, you know, really carried a lot of things. So I'd say, one, when they're shooting, they better shoot really well. But, you know, Maya Nixon has given them good nights and they've had a few people in and out that have done the job at various times, just the guards get all the attention. So the key is she kind of just needs that whole little group there to do a little defending, you know, do a little possession limitation too, and that would help. And since you asked me the previous question, or attempted to, I'm going to shake off the two attempted turnovers and answer anyhow that a big concern I had going in, and we talked about this on the side, David, was that the NCAA home office had a major turnover in the offseason. The committee had a turnover. The committee takes their lead from people that we've come to know, leading us to the mock bracket. So I had a concern just what might happen. And, you know, we just on this call gave some logical reasons. Charlie Krim, even though, you know, a lot of his stuff was off, but what he argued in terms of there were ways to avoid a lot of this. So you kind of wonder, knowing that mix I just mentioned, how much of that kind of discussion went on. So that's, you know, in terms of that. I mean, that's part of your problem in there. Next year will be a little interesting, too, because of this whole Big East breakup. Remember, some of these rules about keeping teams apart, well, technically, however it falls, Villanova could see UConn, for example, right off the bat next year because they're going to be in different conferences.
Good point.
Yeah.
Now, before we get into the sites and that thing, one last hitting on two last two teams. Doug, Tennessee and Kentucky both got two seeds ahead of Penn State. Both had great regular seasons. Both had tremendous years. Are both of those teams really worthy of two seeds? And you know, what do you think their odds are of you know making some noise there? Especially since you know now I will bring it back in. Kentucky having to play on St. John's Court right in the second round.
Well, I mean, I think all three of those teams are obviously really, really good. I think Penn State didn't help its case in the Big Ten tournament and the end of its regular season. It's probably why it fell to a three. I mean, Tennessee won the SEC regular season title and lost in the SEC tournament. And Kentucky, I mean, they were supposed to, on paper, be the best team in that conference. I think they faltered a little bit, but maybe had some quality wins that got them that number two seed. I mean, realistically, two and three to me is not a huge, huge difference. I mean, obviously, you have Kentucky having to play at St. John's potentially in the second round. You have Penn State having to play at LSU potentially in the second round. So, I mean, those two things, yes, you switch them. They still have to play somebody on their home court in the second round. So it's not a huge, huge difference from my standpoint. But you're right. I mean, it's going to be interesting going forward. I know a lot of the coaches I talked to about this whole seeding and playing on other teams' home courts, and they all want the top teams want to go back to the top 16 seeds hosting. I have a real problem with that. Roz mentioned before how Gonzaga has done pretty well on its home court and should be rewarded in having hosting games because it is, I think, one of the best places to play an NCAA tournament because they're really excited there and the crowd gets into it and they support their team and other teams. And this year, as I said last year on your podcast, that Delaware was going to be hosting for the first time this year, and I think that's going to be the most exciting site for the first round this year. So if you went purely by seeding and the top 16 teams are the ones hosting, you wouldn't have Delaware, you wouldn't have Gonzaga. Instead, you have North Carolina, which usually doesn't draw very well at home, and maybe with the tournament, but realistically in the past they haven't. So that probably wouldn't be so great a site. And you probably have some other sites that may not have the most attendance draw. So I know there's flaws in the system, and there always will be, but I'm actually not opposed to the way they have it now, having these teams play on other teams' home courts in the first couple rounds.
Well, the biggest problem seems to be the lack of consistency or the failure to follow their own rules when it comes to putting people at different places. You know, is it an S curve? Is it a G curve? What comes first? Are they supposed to play at each other if they're in the same conference? You know, or not? You know, where does this all come into play? This seems to be the recurring problem, and that's what Roz was talking about especially the Spokane, Washington area just is a mess. You know, from the beginning with the sites with, you know, Cal at Lubbock, you know, Penn State at Baton Rouge, you know, Georgia at Spokane. That's 2, 3, and 4 all playing potential road games on people's courts in the first round. Now, the one in particular that I'll ask about, and Doug, I'll ask you about this, you know, being the national AP guy, is what do you think finally went into this? What is up with Notre Dame being in Iowa City when it was actually closer to send them to Columbus?
Well, it's funny you ask that because I had a conversation with a few people yesterday, two on the committee and with Muffet herself. And I think the first thing, and she admitted that it was their own mistake in a sense. They were going to bid on a host site this year, and somehow, not the Basel office, but somehow paperwork didn't get in time. So draw what conclusions you want, but had they gotten that bid in, they would be playing at home, and we wouldn't have this issue. So that they take some responsibility for them not having their own host game this year, the first round and second round. As far as the Columbus versus Iowa City, I know that Charlie had them going to Columbus, and everyone thinks they should be in Columbus. And, yes, by geography, I think Columbus is a little bit closer than Iowa City is, although I never was very good at geography in school when I was back then. But I think the biggest thing is the committee tried, and this is straight from the committee itself, they tried many times in their bracket to have Notre Dame in Columbus, Ohio, and they just could not get that to work by having all the other teams. And I think it's because the other 15 sites had host teams playing in it, there was no way they could do it where Notre Dame would be headed to Columbus, Ohio, and still be able to have a bracket, a fair bracket. And that said, I mean, look, Notre Dame beat UConn on its home floor twice. It may not be the fairest thing, but if they can't beat Iowa in Iowa, if they happen to play that game in the second round, you have to wonder. They probably shouldn't have been a one seed. And I think they'll have no problem. I think they're going to win that game pretty handily, so it shouldn't be too much of an issue. But there's nothing really the committee could have done this year. They were sort of – they tried. They promised me, and again, I trust these people who I talked to, that they tried every possible way to get Notre Dame to play in Columbus. There was just no physical way they could do it to keep the bracket, to have the integrity they were looking for. So that's the short or long answer for why Notre Dame is in Iowa City instead of Columbus.
Part of the whole goal of the predetermined sites is, you do get to reward your team, and you also get to sell tickets, and you have people that are there that want to see the game. And I find it hard to believe that good television is going to come out of Oklahoma, Central Michigan, UCLA, and Stetson in Columbus, Ohio.
Dave, I feel like the only people who often are complaining about where they have to play, I mean, some coaches and then a lot of media. I feel like players, you just got to come out and be ready to play. And I think Doug kind of said that. If Notre Dame can win at UConn, they got to be able to do it at Iowa City. And I think as a player, you'd much rather play in a crowded court than an empty one. So I actually am okay with the system that gets the most fans to the game. That's what I would prefer. And it's not only whether they're rooting for you or against you. I think it's exciting to be in a full gym, regardless of which side you're on.
That's really my point, because I agree also with what Doug said. It doesn't faze me that Notre Dame's at Iowa City, because Notre Dame should be able to handle any team that they meet in that bracket. Obviously it gets to be a little bit different when you get to some of these other schools. Looking in particular down below there, when you get to Penn State and, looking at Spokane and that problem. But, that just appears to be something that's going to continue to be a problem. Changing to another subject that has people a little bit perturbed, shall we say, some of the fans, with China. The Big 12 has been the number one RPI conference over the year. And much of that, of course, is due to Baylor. And they deserve all of the easy trip to the Final Four that they can get. But Kansas, did Kansas really deserve that spot in particular over some of these mid-majors that have put up good resumes? Their RPI, was not as high as, the Toledos and Duquesne and some of these other schools.
Yeah, I mean, it was, and as I listened to, people on the committee about how, it came down, it was very tight. Unfortunately, I think a lot of these decisions are made based upon tradition. And can I prove it? No. But I think the mid-majors are still a ways away from getting the respect that they deserve, like a Toledo. It is just, it blows my mind that Nama will not play in the NCAA tournament, and that she's been outstanding for Trisha Cullip, in their program. But it's a situation where I think tradition plays out. I think they have really just followed suit with, hey, mid-majors, your conference winner gets in, And then maybe if you have some other team that just totally blows us out of the water with a bunch of top 50 RPI wins, okay, we can't resist. But in all honesty, I think that the respect for mid-major teams and how hard it is to continue to have the kind of success that we see some of these programs having consistently, like the respect is not there. You know, it's the recognition is just not there yet.
To give a shameless self-promotion here, if anybody's listening has not listened to the bonus podcast we put up today with Jose Fernandez and Tricia Cullop, especially you must listen to Tricia Cullop discussing the difficulties that her program has in scheduling opponents. And
yeah,
how
they can't get them, anyone to play.
Will not get them, which she cannot get them to come.
Well, same thing with Hampton. I mean, they have tried, and they did beef up their schedule quite a bit. You know, they've got SEC, ACC, some of them they won, you know, early in the season, but their conference RPI just kills them, and they can only schedule so many games against Power 6 conferences because people won't play them. They just won't.
Well, Mel, let's talk in your turf now. If anybody's going to break through on those mid-majors and raise some noise this year, you know, you got two of them that both had tremendous years that you've seen, of course, in the A-10 and the CAA that are both in Bridgeport, which also kind of stinks to me. But Dayton and Delaware are 6 and 7 seeds. So, Mel, you know, everybody knows about Deladon and everybody knows about what she can do, but Delaware is really a team that is far more than just her. And in particular, I'm getting a little bit of a charge out of the fact that they've got two West Virginia transfers that are playing in, against West Virginia in the first round.
Now, that is correct. And, you know, following the whole Deladon saga, since back here you had to follow it because you grew up with it. You know, at the time she came in and kind of looking at this, how do you grow it? You know, it's you know, I think maybe on some of the podcasts I said before, the all-time greatest recruiting line ever uttered was Tina Martin, the volleyball year of Deladon. My office is down the hall. Anytime you want to talk, feel free to just drop by. And that's the only recruiting pitch that she ever made. And, you know, and at that point in time, you knew they needed other pieces. But then they had these transfers. So I think we're coming anyhow, without regard to Deladon when they were set up. And they were coming from Florida. You know, and you had Trumaine Lucas and you had Akima Richards. And they were coming from West Virginia. And you thought, all right, well, they played in big-time conferences. They know what it's about. And then she was going to get some recruits in to help the board work a little bit. And when that happened, you know, they were still a pretty good team. I mean, considering that Deladon missed the whole front of the season, they did manage to hold themselves together. You know what the great irony is, North Carolina being down there, because before we knew about the Lyme disease coming back, when you looked at that bracket, you said, well, early on they might see North Carolina in a title game, and that'll be a test. So in terms of a do-over, they get to play the game that they never got to play because they got upset by Georgetown and then had to go for the loser's bracket. And they could have won the Georgetown game. They missed a million foul shots that night to start the season. So, yeah, there are a lot. You know, Danielle Parker has been a great rebounder for them. And, you know, and hey, people in the CAA, yeah, the CAA gets undersold a lot. You know, that's a quasi-BCS that's disguised as a mid-major, and which is another thing, these conference shifts. I'm thinking they got to throw the terminology out all together next year. And, you know, James Madison had them on the ropes. Drexel had them on the ropes twice, and they still found a way to win. And she's the equalizer, but being the equalizer, she alone could not have done it without the supporting pieces.
Now, Roz, you're going to be covering St. John's, the St. John's region.
Mm-hmm.
Dayton is a number 7. Talk to me a little bit about whether or not that was, you feel that was a good seed for them, or if they were possibly under-seeded, having only 2 losses this year, even though it's an A-10 team.
Yeah, I think that they've been top 20 for most of the season. You know, of course, I think this goes back to what LaChina said with, you know, tradition, if you will, name brand of a program, and I think that it certainly does upgrade or downgrade your seed. However, if you look at where they are in this bracket, I don't think it's entirely, you know, too unfavorable for them. They do have to take on St. John's at home, but, you know, the Staten team is very solid and has been solid all year long, a very balanced attack. You know, they've got a great freshman in Dean. They've got, you know, four players that score in double digits. That shows balance. That shows consistency. They rebound the ball well. They shoot the three well. Defensively, they're solid. I mean, this is a team that it's more one thing that shows you, too, it's an at-large bid that got them into, and I think what hurt was losing in their tournament. But, you know, when I look at stats before a game, just quickly looking at things, and I see that they can force turnovers, they get steals, you know, but can they also open up the floor on the other end with shooting some threes? This is a solid team, and it's not one player, it's a bunch. So I think they fare well in this region, you know, fare well in this site. You know, really for anyone in the St. John's site, first and second rounds where I'm going to be at, you imagine if Kentucky continues to win through, I mean, the biggest piece is can you handle ball pressure, you know?
That's definitely what Kentucky thrives on. I love the 40 minutes of dread. And Stallworth in particular, coming alive as a post, has been
yep,
phenomenal.
From the Bay.
I don't want to just dwell in the Bridgeport region. It seems like we're lingering there a little bit, but I got to bring up, and I need LaChina to help me here, the biggest upset that I'm picking in the first round. I'm going on record as saying that Albany is going to take out North Carolina. And LaChina has seen Albany a couple of times, and she knows what I'm talking about with them.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. Obviously, it's a different level of athleticism, and I think if Carolina, you know, is to win this game handily, they would have to depend a lot on their athleticism, their quickness, because obviously, you know, the ACC is at a different level from the America East. But I really like Albany. You know, they are a team. They actually play a similar style. They love to press. They'll press the entire game. You know, they have Ebony Henry, who was a back-to-back defensive player of the year in the conference. They actually have a player that is 6'8", and yep. Megan Craig. And so that in itself is a dynamic that most teams aren't ready for, you know, unless you know that you have Brittany Griner coming. And Craig is not terribly mobile. I'm not saying, you know, her skill level is anywhere close to Griner's, but she presents an issue at the rim. And so they're a team that's senior heavy. They've got a couple of great shooters. They have a player named Julie Forrester that I've been raving about since I watched Albany play. She has got a high basketball IQ, very athletic. She's the first player in the history of their women's basketball program to score over 1,000 points and have 1,000 rebounds. So she's someone that I think is a big piece for them. But they're well coached. They're hungry. And they've been dominant throughout league play. So I don't think it's going to be an easy game for North Carolina by any means. And I think that, you know, if they are going to dominate, it will be because they have more athletes than Albany does. But I think it could be a very good game.
You hit exactly on the head. To me, with Albany, it's got to be a case where North Carolina, as inconsistent as they can sometimes be, is going to have one of those off games against the defense that Albany puts out. Mel, you were starting to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say, so are we saying here that if North Carolina loses this game, that Sylvia is the John Calipari in the tournament?
Yeah.
It'll be an interesting one. I mean, I think they're going to need Latifa Coleman, and I was talking about her even early in the season. I love what she does for that team. She's so athletic, and everyone got to see what she was capable of in the ACC tournament. Now, did I think offensively she was going to start making long-range shots? No, but she is so fast. She her ball pressure is outstanding. I just think she takes them up two or three notches, you know, and I would start her in place of Roundtree. I would probably rather have Roundtree coming off of the bench, but I know that she provides outside shooting consistently. But watch for Coleman, because in a game like this where it can get slow and it can be a slugfest, she can come in off the bench and really give them a boost.
I'll give you any choice of brackets. Give me a bracket buster that you see could potentially happen early on in one of these regionals.
I would have to go with South Florida, having seen them play in the Big East tournament. I think they can, I mean, it sounds silly, they could lose first round and they could go for a while. Because they have the Smith sisters who, to me, remind me of the Miami kids from last year, who just have not had a shot they don't like. And if they're hitting them, they'll hit from 30 feet, they'll hit from 35 feet. And they're kind of unguardable because if you can't, you're not expecting a kid to pull up from 25, 30 feet and make it. And they can do that. And then they also have Orokova, who's another good shooter. So if Jose Fernandez's team gets hot offensively, they can, I think, knock off Texas Tech at home, and I think they can give Cal a problem also. So that's a team that can cause some problems in that bracket, at least early on. Or we can see a game that they had where they missed the first 17 shots, and they'll lose first round pretty handily. So that's a team that I'm looking at that could really bust the bracket up and cause some problems and maybe go somewhere to maybe all the way to Spokane.
Roz, what do you think? Same question.
Okay, cool. I'm going to take a little liberty here, and it's not necessarily
over Purdue? Liberty over Purdue?
No.
Is that what you're saying?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying it's not necessarily a huge bracket buster, but I will just quickly give a little love to the Pac-12 in that I think Colorado, I could see them definitely see them into the Sweet 16. And it's not that crazy as they're only a 5 seed, but, you know, you said Kansas, you didn't even know if they should make it into the tournament. And I think that against South Carolina, they play the exact same type of basketball, rebound well, can defend, they're physical and tough, and it's on their home court. I think that's a team you should watch out for.
Mel, do you have somebody that you're keeping an eye on in one of these?
Yeah, I'm looking, but I'm just looking at what she just said, because I got it holding the bracket in front of me, so I know what you're asking me. And isn't that a Big 12 revival game there at Colorado-Kansas game? looking at that matchup.
Yes, you're right, Mel.
You know what? I think you should have noted, but I scribbled it the other night. I had so many things going on. You know, it's great when you suddenly see seven teams you cover make the postseason, and then it becomes a nightmare when you can't really say much about any of them. And by the way, those of you who saw the print version of the Inquirer coin for help, I did not say Delaware was going to be in Newark, New Jersey. So what we learned there is, as coaches would say, never put your story in the hands of the Inquirer coffee desk. So that said, an intriguing game because I've heard a lot about this team, and I see Joe played them, lost to them in a Christmas tournament. But Central Michigan at Oklahoma, you know, I forget the name of the player, but at various times during the year, I had people, you know, just in passing would suddenly bring up in throwaway sentences comments about Central Michigan. So it was no shock for them to beat Toledo. And there could be a team that maybe Oklahoma doesn't know a lot about, and this is, you know, this isn't your grandmother's Oklahoma team at the moment. So that 11-6 could be a very interesting game.
What does that even mean?
Didn't Central Michigan also have Notre Dame on the ropes early in the year?
Yeah, they did. And you know, and it was funny, you know, talking to Trish. Looking up Central Michigan, you know, Central Michigan is the mid-major UConn. They lost to the number one of the mid-majors, Dayton, and they lost twice to Central Michigan. Toledo, I'm talking about, lost once to Dayton and twice to Central Michigan. So they played, it's the same type of situation as the UConn-Notre Dame-Baylor thing, only Toledo doesn't make it into the tournament. And UConn's the number one seed. So there's a little difference there, I guess.
You know what, while we're on Central Michigan, since you all rely on me on history, if it wasn't for Central Michigan, there may not be no women's NCAA. And the reason is this. In 79 AIW Final Four, we all spent a week in Central Michigan, you know, with some of the greats of our game at that time, Old Dominion, Tennessee. And for that whole week held up in like a polar region, literally, And they were great hosts and all, and it was a good time. So I'm not knocking at people in Central Michigan. But I can tell you that all these ADs that came out there said, what the hell are we doing here? And the first thing they did was go home and call the NCAA and said, you got to take women's athletics under your wing. I mean, the true historical input fact that happened. And because it happened after that. Everybody went to Central Michigan and said, we're in a Final Four and we're here. So a little throwback history is you'll get a lot of that as we go through the tournament.
Sounds good. With China, do you have somebody that you think could be an upset?
Well, I like to try to stay consistent with what I say throughout the course of the year, and there have been a couple teams that I've been riding to this point. So, unfortunately, Florida State would have been a team that I said could have done big things in the tournament, but they are going to meet Baylor if they make it through their first round game. So that crushed me. I've talked a lot about Syracuse, and I still think that, that game, if they were both to advance at Tennessee, is not just a gimme game for the Lady Vols. You know, I think I've really had a lot of confidence in Syracuse because of their depth. They have an inside presence. They've got, some freshman guards that are just talented, period, athletic, can shoot it. So I think that could be a game to keep your eyes on. But another one would be if South Carolina was able to advance, and I just think Dawn Staley has done a terrific job. If they meet Notre Dame, that could be a very interesting matchup. I think where we have seen Notre Dame struggle a little bit against the likes of a team like South Florida is their quickness and how fast they are in the guard position. And, Notre Dame has had some breakdowns against dribble penetration. So if that materializes, that could be interesting.
Okay, now changing subjects from teams to players. Doug, we'll start with you again. So who is it that somebody should keep an eye on? And I'm letting you go first because I think in the preseason it was that I took Brittany Boyd and you were waiting on her. You were going to be and you were going to take her then. So I'm letting you have first crack.
I appreciate that. And I'll go off the beaten path because obviously everyone knows about the Gliners and the Deladons and Diggins and all that whole crew. I really like a few players, but the one I'll choose for now, she'll probably only last one round, is Naveen Rashid of Princeton, who I think is just fun to watch, and she goes under the radar as one of the mid-major schools that doesn't get much of the love that some of the bigger schools do. But I have a feeling she's probably going to get drafted somewhere in the WNBA draft. She's led that team. She's lost one league game in her entire career, which I don't know who else besides maybe Brittany Griner can say. So that's a pretty impressive stat. I just think that she's really talented, and if you get a chance to see her against the China's Florida State team, she'll be impressive. So for maybe a one-game maximum, or should I say two games max, they ain't going to knock off Baylor in the second round. But Naveen Rashid of Princeton is my sort of under-the-radar player that I think would be fun for people to actually see play.
Sounds good. Roz, how about you?
Yes. First, I'm going to take one just out of my first and second round sites in Queens, and I'm going to start with Kentucky's Denisha Stallworth. There's so much talk about Audia Mathis, but Stallworth, in addition to Samari Walker, but her presence on the court gives that team the balance inside that they needed to their perimeter play to make them a contender for an Elite Eight, a Final Four, dare I say more. So that team became more than just defense. And now has an offensive balance that makes them dangerous. And I think she's someone you're going to need to watch in this tournament. And she's key to that team's success. How she can bang, score inside, rebound, but also step back for a jump shot and work nicely in the high-low with Samari Walker. So watch for her. And there's just one more player I like in that I've been seeing for a couple of years, and it's Jordan Hooper of Nebraska.
Oh man.
I'm sorry. Did I steal her?
It's okay. It's okay. Naveen Rashid was my other player, so that's okay.
Okay. Well, I love Naveen, and she's also from out west, so we've known about her for a bit. But Jordan Hooper, man, if your name is Jordan Hooper, you've got to be a baller. Seriously. She can jump out the gym. She's got a great point guard, and Lindsay Moore will just throw it up for her. She finishes around the rim, but most importantly, I've seen her play in a couple of close games, and she shows up. You know, she can put the team on her back. She's not afraid. She's tough. And, you know, I could see them, you know, making a nice, where are they, College Station. Yeah, they could go far. They could, you know, sneak into that Sweet 16 behind Hooper and Moore.
Yep, super-duper Jordan Hooper. You kind of love it. Mel, it's your turn.
I'm going to just talk about some of my locals here. St. Joe has two kids that really made a difference, that they're finally back in the tournament for the first time since 2000, where they used to be a regular. one of them is a kid from Holland, Shatila Van Grinsven, who was like a double-double queen in Atlantic 10 this year. And then one of the many of the Maryland spare parts division, people who say I used to go to Maryland, is Natasha Cloud, who was the MVP of the A-10 tournament when they beat Fordham on Saturday. And then a game we really haven't talked about. It's kind of interesting because one of these behind, but out there in that Spokane bracket in the first round, out at Stanford, you got Villanova playing Michigan. Well, that means that, you know, Kim Barzarico wakes up and the first thing she saw was, I left the Big East, but I still have to play Harry Perretta. And, of course, he's got Laura Sweeney, who's a great defender. It may have been three times against Syracuse had she not had the concussion to not be able to play them in the quarter. So Laura Sweeney is another kid that, at least in the first round, I think you should keep an eye on.
Latina?
Yeah, I think I'm going to go with two freshmen that I've been really impressed with because we'll have a long time to be watching them play, but I think they'll be key in their team's run. I'm sticking with Mel and Villanova and Caroline Coyer. You know, I think as senior heavy as that team is, she is the star at the end of games. I mean, Harry will tell you she's the one player that can create her own shot. I mean, she sat out for, 6 weeks or much of the Big East season with a broken hand. She comes back in the Big East tournament, and she just looked great, you know. And I thought, I just think she's got what I call the big game juice. She has that in her veins, and I think she could possibly do some exciting things for Villanova in the tournament. And then I would say Brittany Sykes of Syracuse. I mean, she got everyone's attention when she got the steal on Adira McKinnis and made that heave against St. John's, which wasn't even a heave. It really looked like a shot. Like it impressed me because of her physical strength and what it took to get the shot up with that type of, with, you know, that kind of accuracy. But I think that she just does some things throughout the course of the game that make your jaw drop. She's extremely athletic. And she's very poised and plays under control for a freshman. So I think those two rookies will be two players I'll be keeping my eyes on, both in the Big East.
I'm actually going to go where Roz went with her teams for surprise. I was surprised that you didn't mention her, Roz. I'm going to go in Colorado and say that you really got to see Chucky Jeffrey if you haven't seen her.
I trusted that you would get there. You know, I didn't want to be named a Pac-12 only person.
If last time at the start of the season I picked Boyd and now I'm picking Jeffrey, you know, I may be becoming a Pac-12 person here. but she is a blast, and I'm really hoping that people that get ready for watching the WNBA get a chance to see her and evaluate for their own eyes whether or not this is a player that's got WNBA potential, because I think that she does. And she's just a fun, dynamic, exciting player, and I think that she's great for the game. So, you know, let's see. Hopefully, if Colorado does as Roz predicted and wins a couple of games there, then people will get to see her potentially face off against Skylar Diggins, which should be a really...
Oh.
So, okay, guys, now, instead of going through everything, now... Is anybody picking an upset other than the number one seeds to the Final Four?
I don't want to damage my friendship with Roz, but I do give Cal, you know, a chance. I mean, I think you have to in making it to the Final Four.
I do.
How did
I
we
do
go this long in this podcast and not come down to that? That this is the only like major in conference rivalry that we'll have to see each other again before the Elite Eight. or is it the Elite Eight? No, right? It is the Elite Eight. They're, one of their seasons, if the seeds hold, Stanford versus Cal, it's sad, but I honestly don't know who would win that. If they both, first of all, Cal has to get through Penn State, which if the seeds hold, and that's going to be a crazy matchup. Both teams are so similar, but Stanford-Cal split this season. You know, they did not get the rematch in the tournament because Cal was upset big in the semifinal by UCLA. So there'll be a lot on the line in the Battle of the Bay, and I definitely do not think at all it is a given that Stanford wins that if the two of them meet up at all. It's a must-watch, actually.
I'm going to be Mel and dazzle you for a second here. The last time a non-Stanford team made it that far, 1986, Cynthia Cooper in USC.
Wow.
Wow. You're Mel Jr. now.
It's been a while.
Excellent. All right, I cheated. I listened to Antonelli's podcast, and she gave that out.
Shout out to Deb Antonelli with the knowledge.
Hey, Dave, I got one for you.
The Pac-12 has taken, as you know, the glory years of USC, and then there's kind of a drop-off where it was Stanford really predominantly, but, you know, the Pac-12 has had four teams in the top 20 all season long this year. It's definitely a very different conference where you know, Cal took a piece of that regular season championship. It is not a given. And you know I'm from Stanford, too. It's not a given who would win that if the two of them faced up.
It is nice to see the Pac-12 have this resurgence that it's having this year. Doug, you were going somewhere there.
I just had a crazy stat. In the first round matchup, the Georgia-Montana game, which has two unbelievable coaches who have combined for 1,600 victories, they've only played each other one time in their entire careers, and that was in the 2000 NCAA tournament between Andy Landers and Robin Selvig. So that to me is crazy that they have played all those games and yet they've only played once until they meet this weekend.
Wow.
I think that was a very close game, too, from what I remember. And the only reason I would remember you say that is because we were hosting the Final Four, and I got shipped out west so they could get me out of the way back here. And, you know, like Georgia and Rutgers were on a potential collision course in that bracket. So I had to keep an eye on that team. You know, you had the twins in their youth back then.
Well, you know, Doug, you know, we do have the Smiths in South Florida, but the Tinkles have two girls playing in the women's tournament and the father's coaching in the men's tournament. So that we dub them the first family of basketball for now.
And okay. their brother, the little brother, won their high school state championship. So it's been a good month of March for them.
Wow.
And yeah. Montana is playing in San Jose, California. So Jocelyn gets to watch her dad play. They're all in the same area. She's playing in Stanford and her dad's playing in San Jose.
That's cool, and hopefully they can. I love the T-shirts that they had when the daughters played each other this year. The combined Gonzaga Stanford T-shirts. So we may see those have to be dusted off again this year. All right, guys. So now we're down to the Final Four, and we pretty much have determined that we've got Baylor, Connecticut, Stanford is the question mark, and Notre Dame. But so Notre Dame, Connecticut, Game Four. Doug, you first.
Well,
Doug
let's
already
see,
called
Dave,
his winner from the beginning of the year. Doug, didn't
that's
you?
That's true. I did. I called it in November, I guess, we did the preseason podcast. I said it was going to be UConn-Baylor final with UConn winning. And as crazy as it is, I think that's going to stay true. Rod said it. I mean, to beat a team four times in a year is virtually unheard of. You saw it with beating Baylor 2 years ago. And it's not like UConn has stuff they need to fix except for maybe mentally. I mean, they've lost by, as I said, 9 points or a 1-2 in an overtime game to Notre Dame. So four times in a year, you know, Notre Dame beats them, they deserve it. They deserve to be national champions. But I still have UConn beating Baylor in the championship game in April 9th in New Orleans.
You know, this is 2 years in a row you predicted that.
And they should have won last year, except for an overtime play, a great play by Notre Dame to knock them off in the semifinals.
I will say this, Doug, if that does happen, because one concern I had about Connecticut, and I'll say this quick, Dave, I know you're trying to get this off, but one concern I do have about Connecticut is the number of changes they have had to make deep in the year. I think the more you can keep your lineup consistent, the better off you are. I mean, some of these teams that are on 20-game winning streaks, 21-game streaks, they've been starting the same lineup at least since the beginning of conference play. I don't know how he will move forward, but I love the change with Mariah Jefferson, but will it have happened too late? You know, if Breanna Stewart, you know, Tuck didn't play a lot in the Big East tournament, she was playing a lot coming up to it. Will, you know, Stewart be able to hold in this new setup? So if it does happen, Gino Auriemma has once again, as he did in the Olympics, you know, closed that gap in a small amount of time and brought a team together with some significant changes at a very challenging time of the year.
Well, you're on a roll with China. So what do you think is going to be the outcome headed into the Final Four?
Oh, I'm picking Baylor. I'm sticking with, you know, I believe in Griner, and I believe in Odyssey Sims, you know, and I think Jordan Madden is an underrated defender. We saw what she did to Natalie Novosel last year, and Pope and Destiny Williams are as good as you're going to get on the boards in the paint. I mean, I just defensively, teams struggle against them. I think, you know, as prolific as Griner is on the offensive end, their defense is just smothering. So I'm going with Baylor.
Over?
Baylor over Notre Dame.
There you go. Okay. Now.
And that was a continuation from the conversation about Connecticut. I think it's very hard to make the changes that they have made late in the year and get consistency.
Now, what do you think?
Sometimes you can win four times in a row, even though a lot of my gut says the problem I have with UConn is somewhere they get they might get snaked in Bridgeport, maybe. It's kind of funny because some of these teams have just seemed invincible all year. When they came down the stretch, they started tripping all over themselves. So I'm going to go Notre Dame in a blaze of glory, and when the game is over, the Big East and ACC will shake hands around them as they hand off the Irish to the South.
And then when you get Notre Dame versus Baylor in the final?
Yeah. You know, it was close when they played during the year. And, you know, Muffy kind of said that they figured some things they could have done, you know, maybe that they could do next time around if they meet. So I'll throw the dart.
You going to take Notre Dame?
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, no.
Nice.
Raz.
And that, you know, that'll move on my part.
But, you know, Mel's kind of good. See, you know, if Mel's right, we admit that he is the guru and that he knows all. And if he's wrong, he's just, you know, Mel being Mel. All right, Raz. Stanford's going to win it all? You homer?
No. I think of all the one seeds, right now, I think the team with the most momentum, the most confidence, and has seen the most growth over the course of the year is Notre Dame. However, I do think UConn matches up the best of any of the one seeds with Baylor. One thing Doug said, though, is that the few changes they had to make are mostly mental in their past couple of losses to Notre Dame. I will say it is much easier to make physical changes than mental changes at this point of the year. If you don't got it, if you don't have that factor, that confidence right now, you're not going to get it in a couple of days, and there's too many games too quick. So, you know, ultimately, I think I'm going to go with Baylor to win this whole thing. You're going to ask me against who. I think UConn would be the best matchup against Baylor, but I'm just not convinced that they can beat Notre Dame. You know, I don't know. I think Baylor's going to win it all, though.
And, you know, I want to just, as part of my explanation of my pick, I'm going to address what LaChina said about the changes that were being made. I think one of the things that we all saw in the Big East tournament, which could be a bit of a turning point, is the emergence of Stewart. You could see, I could very easily see Geno playing Hartley, Stewart, Ferris, Dolson, and Mosqueda Lewis 30 minutes in every game, and basically eliminating the changes. Now, with time off in between, I think that if they all play well, which is, of course, the big if, especially with the way that Hartley has been inconsistent and Stewart has been inconsistent in particular, yeah, they have to be on top of their game for UConn to have a chance to go to the finals and to take on Baylor. I do think that it's awful tough to beat somebody four times. And if Gary Blair and A&M could take down Griner's team four times, why can't Ariama take down Muffet's team and Skyler? I do think that UConn will beat Notre Dame in the Final Four just because it's got to happen at one point that McBride's going to miss. He's got to miss one of those shots. Baylor, I don't see anybody getting anywhere close to them through this entire tournament, and that includes the championship game. I think that Baylor is just going to absolutely roll. You're going to see Dunk City all over the place because Kim's going to get her to finally get it, realize that it's over and put yourself in the record books on a high note, and I think that Baylor wins going away. They're just one of the best teams that I've seen in years. I mean, they just play so well as a unit. So that's my thought. Guys, I think we just about did it in an hour. I think I have actually come close to achieving my goal because we started late. I want to thank you all for joining me tonight. China, tell everybody where they're going to see you this weekend. Do you know your, and if you know where you're going beyond that, let us know.
Yeah, I will be in College Park, Maryland, for the first and second rounds, and then I'm headed to Spokane as a reporter on the sideline for ESPN, and then I will work as a reporter for NCAA.com/Turner Sports, getting on all of you guys' nerves in New Orleans and breaking rules and getting in trouble like I did last year.
We can't ever get enough of you, LaChina. That's impossible for you to get on our nerves, that's for sure.
Oh, you're sweet. Thanks.
Roz, how about you?
I'll be heading home to Queens, New York City, the St. John's site for the first and second rounds on ESPN.
And going to check in and continue to update us on the New York Shock as time goes, Liberty as time goes on.
Oh, that's right. Beyond the tournament, I'll be out west a little longer with the Santa Cruz Warriors, the D-League team for the Golden State Warriors. And then for the summer, we'll be heading home to New York. At MSC Network with the New York Liberty and Bill Laimbeer.
It'll be fun, that's for sure.
Oh, Doug, things are rumbling there.
Doug, we always say the best place to find you is everywhere there's a newspaper or a column. Look for the AP byline. But in particular, where are you looking to go this year?
For the Subway.
I'll be joining Roz in lovely Queens for the first two rounds and heading up to visit you in Bridgeport for the regionals. And then on to New Orleans for the Final Four. So that's my itinerary. I get to sleep in my own bed for at least the first two weekends, which is always a plus.
And the Road Warrior, Mel, tell us your trek for the first few days.
Well, it all got easy since even though I had a million teams, they sent most of them to the other ends of the earth, so it became simple. I will start out with you, David, up there in Connecticut, and then I head on the tweener down the Delaware, and I actually, since my house is somewhere in the middle of that route, might even be able to avoid hotel rooms a couple of nights, possibly, depending how things fall, if people aren't alive on Tuesday into St. John's, then back to Bridgeport, and on to New Orleans, and those that know my misfortunes the last several weeks on press row, just keep watching Out of Bounds play because surely I'm going to get hit by another one of them the way things have been going since three of them have happened, one even six rows up in the palestra in the last 3 weeks.
Well, everybody, I want to wish you the best of luck. Safe travels, most important. Let's hope for some great games where the referees are participants and not dictating the action. everybody enjoy, and good luck to you all. Thank you again for spending time with us tonight.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks for having us.
Dave.